KALW.
These were always intended to be temporary. It is both one of the biggest opportunities and the biggest challenges the city has ever faced.
At the beginning of the pandemic, San Francisco rented over 2,000 hotel rooms to move unhoused people off the street.
The people who are in these hotel units are in very poor health condition, likely be a death sentence, sending them back to the streets.
Today, how they plan to move people into more permanent housing. Then we hear the meaning behind singer Valerie Trout's new album, The Oakland Girl.
The Oakland Girl is someone who gives birth and really has a vision for life.
And an incarcerated musician changes his tune after a visit from his sister.
And she tells me, man, why don't you write a song that when I hear it, I'll be proud to say that you're my brother.
That's coming up. I'm Hannah Baba, and this is Cross Currents. Back at the beginning of the pandemic, the city of San Francisco rented over 2,000 hotel rooms for unhoused people. For many, it was the first time in years they had a bed and bathroom to themselves. Now the city's gradually closing these shelter-in-place hotels. It's too expensive to keep them all going. The plan is to eventually move everyone into permanent housing. And if it's successful, it could be one of the city's largest rehousing efforts to date. But critics say the plan is moving too quickly. KALW's health reporter Angela Johnston joins me now to tell us more. Hi, Angela.
Hi, Hannah.
So tell us more about this plan. Why is this happening now?
Well, the city says it was always their plan to phase out the hotel program around this time. They say it costs more to house someone in a hotel room than an apartment or a supportive housing unit. Right now, San Francisco is paying $270 a night for these hotel rooms per room. Mm. So that's $8,000 a month, which is way more than a market rate one bedroom or studio in San Francisco. Even though we have high prices, it's still way more. So the entire operation is budgeted at around $178 million this year.
Okay, but weren't they getting reimbursed by the government?
Yeah, FEMA is going to cover about 75% of the cost. And they have strict eligibility requirements. The person had to be over 65 or have a pre-existing medical condition. It's actually part of the reason there aren't more hotel rooms sheltering people right now, like younger folks or families, despite a call for it at the beginning of the pandemic.
Okay, so how is that going to work? Moving thousands of people doesn't seem like an easy feat.
Yeah, thousands of people in 29 different hotels. Abigail Stewart-Kahn is the head of the Department of Homelessness and Supportive Housing for the city, and I've watched her speak a few times about the plan. She keeps repeating this, permanent housing is the goal. Mm-hmm. Here she is speaking at last week's Board of Supervisors meeting.
And our commitment to rehousing of everyone is stronger than any community that we are aware of in the country. This has not changed. These were always intended to be temporary, and I will be very candid that it is both one of the biggest opportunities and the biggest challenges the city has ever faced in our homelessness space.
She says they've already done a pilot where they said almost 75% of hotel guests wanted to be matched with housing. And so they're planning to do the rest in phases, learning and refining as they go, moving 500 people by the end of December. According to the city, some people have received keys to new housing already.
Mm-hmm. And when do they hope to have everyone out of hotels?
The goal is June of next year, moving a few hotels and a few hundred people at a time.
Okay, and where exactly are they moving to? Does the city have empty housing units that are available right now?
This is where the plan gets really controversial, because the city doesn't have 2,300 empty places available right now. But they say they'll be able to get there. There are some vacant supportive housing units, ones that are available because of just regular turnover. And they also have money from the Tipping Point Community, which is a social safety net nonprofit, and that will go towards a few hundred housing subsidies. Mm-hmm. A person could use a subsidy to rent an apartment for a year if the landlord will accept it. And because rents are dropping and people are moving out of the city, it's expected that maybe more landlords may be willing to accept this.
Okay, and what about the rest, though?
Well, in addition to what I already mentioned, this summer, Mayor London Breed announced a plan to provide more than 1,500 units of permanent supportive housing in the next 2 years. And the city does have funding to do this sort of thing. San Francisco voters passed Proposition C back in 2018, and those funds just became available. Plus, the city just passed Prop A, a bond that would help fund homelessness services. The city is also going to be purchasing some hotels through a state grant called Project Room Key.
Okay, well, all that sounds pretty positive and promising, right?
Sure, but critics say there has to be a guarantee that the city won't move someone out unless there's a place to go. Mm. And because the city can't point to concrete housing options for more than half of the current hotel residents at this very moment, there's calls to stop moving forward with it at all.
So those are big criticisms. Why is that? What did they say?
Well, the main concern is that people are going to end up back on the streets, that the city shouldn't be moving anyone until there are real, actual places to go, not just plans to build them. They say that COVID-19 cases are rising quickly again here in San Francisco while temperatures are dropping. Yes, it may cost money to keep the program running, but it could cost lives if they get it wrong. Mm-hmm. I talked to Jennifer Friedenbach with the Coalition on Homelessness on the phone about this issue.
From what I've been hearing from Department of Public Health folks, the people who are in these hotel units are in very, very poor health condition for the most part, likely be a death sentence sending them back to the streets. So there's some institutional opportunity here to force the city to make sure that we have permanent solutions.
The progressive wing of the San Francisco Supervisors, that's Matt Haney, Dean Preston, Hillary Ronan, and Shimon Walton, they were pretty vocal about the city's failure to get everyone into hotel rooms at the beginning of the pandemic. And they're speaking up again now. Hillary Ronan brought up this point about equity. Like, what about the people who weren't eligible for hotels because they were younger adults or families? And, you know, what about the racial makeup of people who got into hotel rooms and who didn't? Here she is.
What happens to the people that are still on the streets and that are still, you know, losing their homes and ending up on the streets, that are still in the RVs all over District 10? You know, I mean, there are, you know, the family living outside the Bernal Library on Cortlandt Street.
She's worried all of this focus and effort to rehouse thousands of people in 8 months will take some resources away from the people who never got into hotels in the first place. And then there are other interesting concerns.
Like what?
Well, one is that the shelter providers and nonprofits that are helping the city operate the hotels employed a lot of people. And there's a worry that when they close, there will be hundreds of people who are out of work just in time for the holidays. Also, there's this worry that in the absence of resources like housing, the city will just give people a bus ticket out of town.
Hmm. So, Angela, what is the city's response to all these concerns?
Well, they say they can't afford to wait. They have to begin this process now so they can learn from it. Homelessness and Supportive Housing Director Abigail Stewart-Kahn says she understands the fears that there aren't enough places to house everyone at the moment, but she says that's why they're doing it in phases. And while there may not be permanent solutions for everyone, she says there will be maybe medium-term ones, like short-term subsidies. And the city also says that with all the homeless funding that's becoming available, there should be other support positions available for the former hotel workers.
All right. Thanks, Angela.
Thanks, Hannah.
Angela Johnston is KELW's health reporter. You're listening to Cross Currents from KELW News. I'm Hannah Baba. When singer Valerie Trout was a kid growing up in Oakland, the community embraced and recognized her talent, and they supported her. Members of her church would buy her tickets to concerts and musicals to expose her to all types of music. That support and her parents' encouragement influenced Valerie. Her jazz and gospel vocals have been heard all around the Bay Area. Valerie's second album is called The Oakland Girl. It's a coming-of-age narrative that she wrote 20 years ago while actually living in New York City, but the themes of growth and love still resonate today. Valerie Trout talked about the album with KELW's Janae Darden, who's also an Oakland girl.
I grew up in East Oakland. And I know you spent part of your childhood in East Oakland. We are 90s kids. What was East Oakland like for you back in the 90s?
Man,
It was blackety black, 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 you know?
Yes, it was.
It was very exciting. There were also some very scary parts of Oakland that I was just like, yeah, not so much.
Yeah. You know, the 90s, I'm thinking back to the 90s too. That was also such amazing, wonderful time for music. How did music in Oakland impact you as an artist?
My father was a singer. Well, he still is a singer. He just doesn't sing that much. He had a group called The Chain Reaction, and they did R&B and like doo-wop. And my mother, she just, you know, just loves, you know, music, jazz and blues, things like that. But in Oakland, you know, we had what's now the New Parish was Sweet Jimmy's.
Hey, all you ladies, put on your red dress. Make up your face. We're going down here and party at Sweet Jimmy's place. Come on.
Remember Sweet Jimmy's?
Of course.
Right? You know, of course, I was way too young to necessarily be going to Sweet Jimmy's, but they had a food section. So my mom would take me, right? And then I would sit in the food section, and sometimes they would have the music in there, too.
Wait, so you were young going to Sweet Jimmy's? So for people who don't know, Sweet Jimmy's, I remember, the only way I knew about Sweet Jimmy's was because of Soul Beat. And they would show Sweet Jimmy's, which was a nightclub. And they would, like, have footage of people partying. It was almost like our own Soul Train, right? Like those videos. Sweet Jimmy's is like an Oakland, it's like an Oakland gym. So the fact that you were at Sweet Jimmy's.
I was at Sweet Jimmy's. And you know how it was on San Pablo during that time.
Yes.
You know, maybe a kid should not be there. But my mom was like, you got to hear this singer, you know? And so she would take me, and I remember one of the singers that stuck out to me was Barbara Morrison. But she would take me there to see Ed Kelly play piano. Faye Carroll was singing there. It was, you know, soul food, and you got to get, it was The Color Purple, honey. It was real. You know what I'm saying? It was the juke joint.
I want to talk about The Oakland Girl, your album. And I want to talk about the title song. I was listening to it. You are an Oakland girl, clearly. And I listened to the song, and it's about loss and trying to survive and this hope for freedom. Mm-hmm. What inspired that song?
Mm-hmm. When I wrote the song, I was living in New York.
She walked into the club, dressed in her finest gear.
And so I was clinging to who and what I knew as my own truth. And, you know, in terms of where I came from and then also what I was longing for. And, you know, like you're saying, you know, to be free. And then also knowing that, you know, I come from this place, Oakland, that has a lot of joy and triumph, but then also a lot of pain. And so I started to weave the stories of the young women that I knew in my life together through that song. She's an Oakland girl. Some of them are still living and have thriving families, or, you know, are living and they're fine and okay. Some of them have passed on. You know, as I look at it now, you know, 20 years later, I feel like, you know, I have flown and I have come back, and I am in acceptance of who I am, you know, and I don't necessarily have to fly away to be who I am, you know, and also be connected to my roots or my spirituality.
What does it mean to be an Oakland girl now?
I think that it means to be someone who is rooted in their culture, in their the spirit of Oakland, in its radical inclusivity. So I think that the Oakland girl, you know, it is a girl. The Oakland girl is a woman. The Oakland girl is someone who gives birth, someone who is a holder, you know, of space, and, you know, really has a vision for life.
You know, we're talking about the culture of Oakland, and one thing I know about people from Oakland, we keep it real. And in your song, you have another song in your album, you know, called "You Suck," and it's jazzy, mature, and then it's just straightforward. It's like, you didn't call me back, and you playing around, you wasting my time, and you know, you suck. Was that fun to write and record?
It was. It was a lot of fun because I didn't expect it. But some people drive you there, you know?
Mm-hmm.
People, sometimes we suck. You know, we're not accountable for certain things.
I thought you said you'd call me.
You know, but because of all of our trauma and not dealing with things, we're not able to trust ourselves enough to trust ourselves with people.
Was it a challenge to put this album together today since the songs came from 20 years ago?
There was no stress putting this project together. The concepts and the language, they were relevant then and they're relevant now.
But you suck, darling, you suck. Oh.
That was singer and songwriter Valerie Trout speaking with KALW's Janae Darden. Valerie's new album is called The Oakland Girl. Find out where you can stream it. We've got a link at KALW.org.
I thought you said you said you like me, yeah. I guess I'm too young to understand an old cappy, but it's too late.
This is Cross Currents. I'm Hena Baba. Next, we're headed to Solano State Prison to hear from the Uncuffed team about a man feeling remorse for murder and expressing it through music.
From Solano State Prison,
this is Uncuffed.
Remus Sam Longy is serving 38 years to life on a second-degree murder conviction. In prison, he's become a guitarist and a songwriter, and recently he wrote a song about the people he harmed. Remus spoke with Uncuffed producer Brian Mazza.
How does Remus Sam Longy, a Pacific Islander in prison for life, adopt his Tongan ceremonial tradition to compose a remorseful song of healing?
I stole her sunshine.
Malolele.
Malolele.
How are you today?
Saibe.
Tell me about your last name, Longy.
My last name, it goes back as my grandpa's grandpa. The chief had told my ancestor to build him an estate in downtown Nuku'alofa. And then my ancestor replied back and told him and said, I'll build my estate in the heavens. Thai chief told him like, well, what about your descendants? What about those after you? What will they inherit? My ancestor told him they will inherit the heavens. Yeah, I'm an inheritor of heaven, you know.
Would you mind sharing what happened that night?
It was December 21st, 2002. A friend of mine invited me to come out to a barbecue that was thrown at night. It was a nighttime barbecue. And then after the barbecue, we drank. There were other group of gentlemen that was outside across the street. Altercation took place. And the police got there and we all arrested and stuff. And then I didn't realize it was serious till we got to the county jail. And they told me that you better hope this guy wakes up, man. And I was like, what? I don't remember. I don't remember it being that serious, man. Family decided to pull his plug on Christmas Day, and my charges changed from attempted murder to homicide.
Okay, talk to me about your victim's family.
They was always showing up to my court dates, you know?
You were well aware of the impact that you had on that family.
Yeah.
So talk to me one day. You're talking to your brother. Tell me about that.
Man, it was crazy, man, when I had to translate for Dad, man. My own dad was apologizing to the family. My dad don't speak English, you know? And he said something about, even though my son is going to prison, you know, I'm still fortunate in the sense that I can still talk to him, you know? When he told me that, it made sense for me because when I look back, there was a period where the victim's family stopped showing up.
So whatever your dad told them?
My dad's apology, I believe it came off across as, you know, maybe.
Your victim's family stopped coming to court.
Man, they stopped showing up. They didn't even come for trial. They didn't even come for the sentencing. They just...
They started healing. What your dad told them started the healing process for them.
I believe that back in the Polynesia, like if a party even kills another party, right? Before the sun rises, they go and they wear a bulo, like a tapa cloth, and they sit in the front of the victim's family's house, right? The family can do whatever they want to do with them. They can kill them, they can retaliate, they can do whatever they want to do. And if not, the family will come out and forgive them. That's exactly what my dad did.
You're still writing music, and most of your music had negative connotations to it.
Growing up in the neighborhood I grew up in is going through the juvenile hall system and stuff, like raps was like how we kill time.
Tell me about what happened when your sister comes to visit you.
She asked me, hey man, so I'm hearing from Vallejo and them and all your nephews that you've written so many songs, you know, all you do is write songs. And I was like, yeah, I got a lot of them. Well, sing me one of your songs. Let me hear one of your songs. And I was going through which song would be appropriate, you know, to sing for my sister. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't think of one.
Because of what?
Because of the content of the songs, you know what I mean?
Right.
Like the taboo is we can't swear when we're around each other. We can't, I can't be in her room. She can't be in my room. We can't even watch TV together.
So you weren't able to share any of your music with your sister at that point in time?
None.
Tell me what happened after that. With your creativity, that is, what you wanted to do.
She tells me, it was a turning point for me. She tells me, you can't sing one song, huh? It's like, nope, I can't. I said, why? It's like, kap kap it. Meaning swear words, huh? It's like, yup. And she tells me, man, why don't you write a song that when I hear it, I'll be proud to say that you're my brother. Or if your nieces hear the songs, that they'll be proud to say that you're their uncle, you know what I mean? You sing beautiful songs. And that kind of like sparked this whole thing for me that I had never written my letter of remorse. And I go to what's natural for me, you know what I mean? Like
the music.
The music. So I go back to playing the guitar. And when I'm playing the guitar, this song comes to me, man.
I stole her sunshine. Robbed her blind in the middle of the night.
That was Remus Sam Longhi performing his song Heaven Please with guitarist Joseph Kaufman. That story was made by Brian Mazza in Solano State Prison, and there's an extended version of it on the Uncuffed podcast, available at weareuncuffed.org. Uncuffed is supported by the California Arts Council and the Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. The producers fact-check content to the best of their ability, and all content is approved by an information officer.
Tears of sorrows, she's never felt so broken, say. She's never felt so broken and shattered. Heaven, please help her make it through the night. Heaven, please let us see a better tomorrow. Heaven, please.
Today's Cross Currents team includes Scott Carroll, Sonia Narang, Marissa Ortega Welch, Jessica Placek, Lisa Ramreka, Andrew Seltzer, and Eli Wirtschafter. Our engineers are James Rollins and Gabe Graben. Production manager is Shireen Adil. Managing editor is David Boyer. News director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.